This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. President Obama used last night's State of the Union address to position himself as a champion of the middle class. He called on Congress to raise taxes for the wealthiest Americans to pay for services like childcare and rising health costs. But he also took a minute to ask Congress to pass a bill that would beef up this nation's cybersecurity.
Tonight, I urge this Congress to finally pass the legislation we need to better meet the evolving threat of cyber attacks, combat identity theft, and protect our children's information. That should be a bipartisan effort. You know, if we don't act, we'll leave our nation and our economy vulnerable. If we do, we can continue to protect the technologies that have unleashed untold opportunities for people around the globe.
Well, in light of the recent hack of Sony Pictures Entertainment, the president says he wants to make the internet a safer place. But critics worry whether it's enough to stop cyber terrorism and whether it might cost citizens their privacy. Joining me to talk about cybersecurity is Lori Williams. She leads the Department of Computer Science at North Carolina State University. Lori, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here.
Also with us, Zach Nunn. He's a former director of cybersecurity for the National Security Council, now a cyber operations officer for the U.S. Air Force and a state representative in the Iowa State Legislature. Zach Nunn, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks, Frank. Appreciate being on.
Lori, the president talked about identity theft, foreign hackers, so personal, corporate, national security, all of that. What do you think is the greatest concern when it comes to cybersecurity today?
Well, I think it's the balance between privacy and security and the situation. And so the president is, you know, I believe trying to go for our best interest. But in our best interest, yes, maybe our privacy could be compromised in some way. But similar to, you know, if you're in an ambulance and you're ready to die, you know, dying, you'll give any information just because of that emergency. Well, we can have those kinds of emergencies from a national security perspective. And, you know, giving away our privacy in that situation is a smart thing to do. But it could be abused. So the balance between the two is important.
So you point to a national security moment when we might have to take all of that information about us that is aggregated on the web, and it might have to just go public. Suddenly, for national security, the government gets a hold of it. But there's another question here, and that is when we don't give anybody permission, not the government or anybody, they hack in and take that information, and that also seemed to be on the mind of the president.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there's some technical aspects, the way that software is developed that would help prevent that. But one of the aspects he's talking about is data sharing. And if companies share data, so they're under attack and they shared that data, maybe they defended themselves, but yet there's clues about who did it. And if they're sharing that, that may prevent another company from being attacked. So, you know, he is proposing a data sharing and a voluntary data sharing, and there could be some privacy implications with that as well.
All right. Well, Zach, how does vulnerability change when you shift from private companies and private individuals to the military and cyber warfare?
Yeah, and so Lori brings up some really good points. On the government side, obviously, we have less concern about the individual privacy issues, but we certainly have concerns about national security and what type of information is exposed. And so we saw, even here last week, where U.S. CENTCOM, the military area of responsibility for Iraq and Afghanistan, were basically breached on their YouTube and Twitter accounts by a handle called Cyber Caliphate, representing ISIS. And what they did is they were able to collect information, and through a soft target, using the private sector's YouTube and Twitter accounts, they were able to expose information that they thought would embarrass or potentially weaken U.S. Central Command. So there's a question here on what the government can defend within its own network, what it is able to defend in the networks that we all use, and then there's also the relationship that the public-private sector has in what we call the cascading effect. So when there is a fault in the power grid on the private sector, that could still have a real dramatic effect on the Department of Defense or on the U.S. government at large. Also, conversely, when there is a threat to a Department of Homeland Security watch list or the IRS and private citizens' information is exposed due to a hemorrhage of information from a government sector, there's also a liability issue.
Well, you also, I think, embedded in your answer was another part of the problem. You said that this was a sort of ISIS broke in and got this information to embarrass the United States. And, of course, we don't really know. I mean, if you have an army and they have insignias on their uniforms, we get who they're where they're coming from. It is precisely that problem with cyber terrorism that if I wanted to embarrass ISIS, that's exactly what I would do, right? I mean, that's part of our problem.
Yeah, I think absolutely there's the question here of attribution, identifying who did it, and then also in a cyber realm, being able to identify how we want to respond. I thought the president was clever in his response to North Korea in an asymmetrical attack against Sony Corporation, and the U.S. responded in saying, hey, we don't necessarily need to have a cyber response for a cyber attack on a private entity, but we are going to respond very vigorously with FBI attribution. We will call it out publicly, and we will respond with the entire instruments of power that the U.S. government has. And in this case, we used diplomatic and financial sanctions versus something that I think a lot of people would say, well, hey, a cyber attack on us means we would respond in kind with a cyber attack on them.
But the asymmetry, Laurie, I think is something that points to yet another problem. The fact is very few people can bring down a whole economy and cause serious problems for a great national entity like the United States. Pretty easy to do. What are some of the common ways? I mean, how easy is it to sort of break in and cause mayhem?
It depends, and it is industry dependent, like the finance industry. I'm going to say they do lead the pack with using good security techniques. In other industries, not so much. So in some industries, it would be real easy to get in.
What would that legislation look like, Laurie? I'll stick with you. The president called for comprehensive legislation to protect. Well, what does that look like? How do you do that, given all of the, you know, again, the asymmetries involved in this particular kind of warfare?
You know, so what he's proposing, this data sharing, and then he's limiting the liability. I don't know the specifics of it, but limiting the liability of industries that participate. I mean, the banking industry, you can, as you mentioned, take lots and lots of money out of a bank, and they lose that money. And there could be liability for identity theft and other liabilities that if the government can help them with that, then they're incentivized. There are lots of, from a national standpoint, a lot of education that needs to be done so that people do code securely. How can the president work with that? You know, I guess he can work with that.
Zach, I wonder structurally, and this may be sort of beyond the scope here, but structurally how you do that. You're trying to work within sort of a national legislature, right, a national political structure to protect what is essentially a global infrastructure that is connected to a global economy. All that can come down. If you decide to get into, you know, Bank of America and some of the larger financial institutions, how does the United States of America, you know, sort of protect those assets and protect them from liability?
No, Frank, you bring up a perfect example. And I'll highlight one instance which happened 2 years ago where a Twitter account for the AP was hacked. And we saw the Dow Jones take a multi-million-dollar tumble in a matter of seconds. And even though it was proven later to be false, they said there had been an attack on the White House and the president was injured. Markets respond instantaneously to that. And what used to take us weeks at a time to transfer data is now taking us an eighth of a second. So when we look at policy options to catch up with where technology has already led us, we really need to look at where that relationship begins between government, between private sector, and internationally. When we were on the National Security Council, we proposed several pieces of legislation. Primarily, though, we have found that it's been most useful to use a presidential policy directive. We passed or signed into law Presidential Policy Directive 21, which brought together critical infrastructure. And the real key here was sharing that information. Laurie talks about incentivizing the private sector to share. There's certainly that liability coverage that they need. The government also has a lot of restricted information that we can't just share because of sources and methods, how we got it, but we can give signatures or talismans on, hey, here is a threat vector that we see increasing in this area, sharing that information proactively. And what we would look for on the government side, and particularly on the national defense side, is seeing private sector being a integral partner in providing that information back. Here's what we're seeing in our systems. When we are breached, that we have the ability to send a flyaway team that can do the level of attribution we need to be able to determine, hey, was this a threat actor? Was this an individual hacker potentially? Was this a nation-state actor? And there are a lot of signatures out there that can really clearly define for us that level of attribution. It's not always possible, but once we have that partnership established, then we can actually identify what we call cascading effects. So again, going back to the idea here, if the financial sector is attacked, this not only affects pick any bank in Wall Street, this affects everything that's happening on the London market, that's affecting the Tokyo market, and if there's not a response already on the shelf that you can pull down, you will find that the financial sector will quickly cascade into a situation where we have real loss as well as virtual loss.
And Laura, you point out that not only is the game instantaneous, but it's also long-term. People wait a long time. An example of a company that watched an attack take place over a long period of time.
Yeah. So I was sharing the story that there was a company that I can't name, but they saw that they were being attacked. So, you know, big companies, they have, you know, a dashboard kind of a thing where they're watching who's, you know, intruding and who's attempting to intrude. And so they saw intruders and they, you know, changed their systems and, you know, sure enough, they stopped the intruders for a bit, but then they resurfaced and they changed them again. They resurfaced and they eventually got to the point where they had collected so much information. They knew exactly by name who was doing it. And they kept advancing, you know, over time, over a period of years. Eventually, they bought a company who had the technology they thought would stop these intruders. And that didn't even stop them. So eventually, after several years, they got in.
They got in. To be continued. We will continue the conversation, but I want to thank both of you. Laurie Williams is head of the Department of Computer Science at NC State. Zach Nunn, former director of cybersecurity for the National Security Council. Thank you both for being on the program.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Just ahead, the producers who run the popular podcast Criminal on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.